Welcome to MSP 1337. I'm your host, Chris Johnson, a show dedicated to cybersecurity challenges, solutions, a journey together, not alone. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of MSP 1337. I'm joined this week by Ted White of Vertical Talent Solutions. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Chris. Great to be on.
So Vertical Talent Solutions, it's kind of in the name a little bit, but it doesn't really say why I would bring somebody in the talent solution space onto a cybersecurity podcast. So I want to frame this up for our listeners. Every single MSP is challenged by having the right FTEs, having the right employees in their organization. And since we do focus on cybersecurity, that talent pool obviously shrinks even further really fast. And so as you and I were talking before we started this episode, some things you highlighted for me were really big eye openers. And so I just thought we would start with, if you could just give us a little backstory on how you landed here. I know it started somewhere around 2017, working with an MSP. Talk to me about that experience and why you shifted the way you did to focusing solely on the MSP space.
Absolutely. So yeah, I'm located in West Hartford, Connecticut, and spent about 15 years in corporate before I started Vertical Talent Solutions 10 years ago. Our first managed service provider customer here in town, we kind of taught each other the game of recruiting. We went back and forth and basically troubleshooted the scenario, and we had a lot of fun doing it. I really enjoyed working with them, and fast forward like 3-4 years or so, we had 25 hires with the organization. They were able to grow from about 20 to 60 people or so in general, and were able to merge with a much larger managed service provider. And I didn't really realize what we were doing at the time, but it was a lot of fun helping the company. And I thought, man, I'd like to do that over and over and over again. And so I did. I went out and sought other managed service providers to work with. I let go of some of our enterprise customers because they weren't as much fun.
Sure.
And we got along really well with most all of the MSPs that we talk with, and especially our customers that we work with. So we're like-minded, and you know, I can get to the common denominator of what is like-minded, and it comes down to being troubleshooters. You know,
yeah, I like that you refer to your staff as troubleshooters. I'm like, you know, about us, and it's like our troubleshooters. And I'm like, oh, do they like have a dev team? Like, is this some sort of like tech support strategy? No, I love it. I love it. It's a great way to describe staff in such a way that makes it tell me that out of the gate, you're already working to come up with a solution, as opposed to what do they say? If I come to you with a problem or a complaint, I'm either part of the problem or part of the solution, depending on what I bring along with that.
You must have been tapped into my conversations earlier this morning.
I was not, but obviously we seem to be like-minded as well. I think anybody that is an MSP, from what you've shared, would get along splendidly. I know that your recruitment process has about 5 stages to it. One of the things that I thought was super interesting, and you and I were talking about this, is, you know, it's one thing to hire somebody and get somebody that has the skill set and the understanding, you know, largely the experience in the IT space. That's one of the hardest things to find, especially when you're looking for someone that's more in that level 2, level 3 engineer space, or is more of that salesy account management consultative space. And so, which all kind of revolves around like, okay, how do I find somebody that's the right fit? I think that's your first stage, is to find the right candidate. And obviously finding the right candidate for your, as a recruiter, it obviously can be a little bit different out of the gate before we start talking about the MSP and their needs. But one of the things that you and I talked about was culture, and how culture, not just the internal culture of the organization, but I think to some degree, we're largely seeing an impact on what MSPs and businesses in general are having impact their organizations when they go about this hiring process. Because, and I don't want to demographically label it, but there's a large volume in certain demographics that they just don't have this, like, the world is bigger than me.
Yes. So In those cases, first of all, we did a lot of marketing in 2020. We did a lot of, figuring out the marketing, aspect of our business and reaching out to managed service providers. And we quickly realized that marketing and recruiting are very, very similar. So you've got a market, you go for your target market, you go for the people that you want to get in front of. And we get in front of people that are not looking for jobs. We're not out there posting jobs or anything. We're tapping on the shoulders of people who are sitting pretty happy with their current job, pretty much. But we're reaching out saying, hey, would you consider another opportunity in not so many words? And when we prefer those candidates over posting a job and things because the applicants, they're interviewing with five, six different companies and they get a little confused. When we're approaching somebody, it's more like, hey, I was either thinking about one or I'm happy where I am and I haven't interviewed in a while. It has to be really good. Well, there's a reason we're reaching out to them. If they've been a Tech 2 or a Tech 3 for 3 years at their current MSP and they haven't been promoted, that's a signal to us that says, hey, this person wants to talk with us. So when we start talking with them, it's all how they interact with my team at the beginning. And you treat one person the same way that you should treat another. There should be kind of no difference. As long as they're polite with my recruiters and they're consistent about being polite and good people, hungry, humble, and smart, and they make it up through the filtering system. We talked with them, and if we enjoy working with them and they're consistent about their expectations, they have the right skills, and of course they're troubleshooters, and we can get an idea, based on some behavioral-based interviewing that I've done, if they're going to be a good fit, not only for one customer, it's more of a collective thing. Like, the majority of MSPs are looking for the same type of people, so there's not a lot of variables to change in that aspect.
So job placement and all of that, your timing for 2020, I mean, we're talking about the pandemic has landed. So like when you called somebody, there was a good chance they were answering the phone because they were at the phone.
True.
What was that like? Because I feel like we changed the entire world overnight when it comes to going to work or having a commute that was largely tied to getting in my car, fighting traffic, listening to podcasts like this one, to get to destination and then work for somewhere between 6 and 8 hours and then turn around and do the same thing all over again. During that process, what happened? What changed? Was it like an instant, like, oh my goodness, it's a gold mine now from a candidate potential because you no longer are saying, well, I really only want people that are in a 15-mile radius of Hartford or fill in the blank, right? Like, what was that like?
It was interesting. There was a little bit of course of a pause in the world for a
Sure.
period of time. But we
March
did
10,
tar
2020.
That's right. That's right. We did target people that and talk with a lot of candidates whose employers wanted them to be in the office at that time. They weren't too happy about it because they were hearing about
Sure.
their friends having some flexibility. And luckily for us, we had customers that were okay with, remote situations, hybrid situations, and they were hiring people just based on doing video interviews, which, as you
Sure.
said, was a first.
Right.
So that was pretty much the game involved there, being comfortable with interviewing and making decisions, even not having met somebody in person. That was new back then.
Right.
That really, really cool.
So, talk to me a little bit about. I feel like we've covered stage one and stage two. I think anybody listening, this is where everybody has challenges. And I've heard some interesting things that MSPs do on the interviewing side of like, okay, we've got a puzzle situation and I need you to answer in, 10 words or less. And then if they can't answer it in 10 words or less, they're like, yeah, we're not hiring. But like, what kind of process do you go through? Because the things that I see happen a lot in the MSP space is you can have somebody that interviews really, really well. They've gone through three boot camps, they've got four CompTIA certs, and if the right questions aren't asked, they tend to you know, excel greatly on that tech skills interview, and then they're on day three of the job, and you're like, oh my word, how did we end up with this particular candidate?
That's a really great question, and if I can give and provide takeaways on this podcast, that's what I intend to do. The main thing, Chris, that we did initially, we were talking to a lot of candidates out of the industry, in the industry, and it would take about, you know, 15, 20 or so, let's just say, candidates to get a hire back in those days. Sure. But what we found is if we had one or two of those candidates were from MSPs, those are the one or two that we end up placing. So I realized efficiently that we needed to switch our target, you know, again, back to the target marketing, on the right people. And the right people are the industry MSP candidates, especially the ones that have been with the managed service provider for at least 3 years, because that eliminates the job hoppers. That eliminates somebody who might join your MSP and then bail within 6 to 12 months or so. Sure. They're in it. But the major play here was, you know, talking to candidates, as you referred, you know, solve this puzzle. Those companies are trying to figure out if the candidates have the ability, what level they are with critical thinking. Mm-hmm. Well, if you've got a couple of variables kind of checked off, they're not a job hopper, they're in the managed service industry, they know how to handle 20 to 30 plus customers at a given time, they're pretty cool, they have a good customer interaction ability, well, let's dive in a little bit and figure out if they're, you know, if they have the chops. So what we do as troubleshooters ourselves is try to identify what level of troubleshooter they are. And what I mean by that is, you know, you talk about hobbies and what you do in your spare time, but literally I can narrow it down to these few things. If somebody is in their house and something breaks, or something breaks on their car, and they don't like hiring anybody to fix these things, then they're a troubleshooter. If they have a server, of course, you know, we all have that one covered. But if they're a former athlete, if they're an artist, if they taught themselves how to play a guitar, and if they, you know, do those fixing things, that's all repetition, and it's all trial and error, and it's all practice and making things better and better and better. So that way, we've been able to identify if there's a troubleshooter on the other end and somebody who can pass a very strong critical thinking portion of an interview.
So that's funny you say that, because it made me think, like, you're getting this from asking some questions. You know, what do you do in your spare time? Like, oh, I rebuilt a, you know, 97 Corvette, whatever. It's interesting, because I remember in college, or actually it was in high school, taking the aptitude test, like, and then depending on how well you did meant how many phone calls you were going to get from, you know, Navy or whatever branch of the military that's suddenly very interested in what your potential is for them. And you're slowly going, I took a test called an aptitude test. Basically, I understand how you can actually get the square peg to fit into the round hole. And now someone's calling me, like, I'm so confused, right? But that's what you're describing, right? You're saying, like, proof of critical thinking. Do you use other methods? Like, I was thinking, like, one thing that came to mind for me was, like, are you familiar with Patrick Lencioni's The Working Genius?
Yes, actually, that's something. I was just looking at a book to see if that's the one that I have here. No, it's The Five Dysfunctions of a Team is the one I have here.
So that's a good one. I mean, you can see behind my head, I have most of the Patrick Lencioni books. But The Working Genius is kind of like a, you know, the Myers-Briggs or the, you know, DISC profile. But it's very much about, you know, the working profile. And I was just curious, as a recruiter, that what thought that entered my head is one of the things that's in The Working Genius is it talks about the things that give us joy. So they have, it's like widgets. So it's like wonder, invention, discernment, and enablement, and galvanizing. I think I got it, man. I don't even looking at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have two letters that you get tagged with for each of those. So like mine is, I'm a, I don't even remember.
Probably I'm an enabling.
I'm enabler and galvanizing, or something to that effect, or galvanizing enabler, which was interesting because then you have like a place that's also your comfort level. So it might be invention or discernment. And then you'll have two that are like the area that just frustrate you and make you miserable. And what's interesting is identifying, you know, those, like when you would talk about recruiting, like So they've been there 2 to 3 years. They haven't had the pay increase. Some of those things obviously very much are important to, you know, no one says no to a pay increase usually, unless it's suddenly like what comes with it that you didn't want to do. But you have things in there like, I had no idea that this thing that I'm really, really good at is the thing that gives me the least amount of joy. And if you've identified that for that particular candidate and say, hey, we want to place you over here, these are the things that you would be doing. And they're like, well, that's what I love. That's my most, I get up in the morning to do that. And it's called playing the guitar, right? Like, or something along those lines. I was just curious because it, you know, the way you described that made me think about some of those ways in which you identify from a personality type.
Yeah.
The love hate relationship with work.
Yeah, you know, it's really about fixing things, quite honestly. I personally, I have a go-kart, and I've never been all that, you know, I've never really done too many things with engines before, but this past January, I figured, all right, I want this winter to fly by. I'm going to learn how to take this engine off, take it apart, rip out the governor, and just tinker, and I did that. And it brought me a lot of joy. Like, I'd come into, you know, I hit a roadblock, hit a bit of a challenge, think about it, do some research, look on YouTube, watch some videos, and finally you get it going, and it just brings you joy, it brings you pleasure. And it's really what I just described was a lot of what troubleshooters do as system administrators, as tech twos, tech threes, engineers. And if that brings them joy to do those kind of things, and they're getting paid to do what they love. And those are the candidates that we like.
But the YouTube video thing, that makes me pause a little bit, because I've done a couple, you know, DIY projects with cars, and I'm like, oh, I watched the 7-minute video, and then it took me 3.5 hours to do what they did in 7 minutes. And you're like, they should not be allowed to do that without some sort of disclaimer that says, this is the 1,000th time that I've done this, and this is your first time doing this.
Yeah,
you will take longer than 7 minutes.
Oh yeah, yeah. I usually say it takes me at least 10 to 20 times longer than a professional or you know, some type of video would do. You're right, the repetition and the amount of times they've done those things is just unfair.
Do you think that sometimes, though, applying this back to the job spot, that you also have to take into consideration, like, okay, at what point do they recognize that this is taking too long, or that this is no longer a realistic task for them to complete, that it needs to be bring somebody else in or let someone else know that you need help?
Yeah, good point. I think there are some people that who kind of get lost in time when they're right. focused on something and don't realize how long they're taking. Whereas, you know, I have one of my employees sets a timer, and he does something for about 30 minutes or so and says, nothing's going to interrupt me for that. There you go. See?
Like one of these.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a tomato theory or tomato thing. I don't know.
Pomodoro.
Pomodoro. Yeah. Yeah. And which I absolutely love. I think that you can give yourself a certain period of time, like painting
a
ceiling.
Creating an internal SLA.
There you go. Doing a proposal, creating a contract, or painting a ceiling.
Sure.
And you say to yourself, man, if I don't give myself a time limit on the ceiling, I'm going to spend all day. So guess what? I'm going to, and you go totally unrealistic. I'm going to say,
sure.
I'm going to give myself 30 minutes.
Yeah.
With what would take me all day if I don't do this, I'm going to give myself 30 minutes. And wouldn't you know it, in 30 minutes, you're going to be done. You might have some paint to clean up a little bit.
Sure.
But, you know, those are the types of people, the people who you can tell kind of get lost, and they're, I don't think that they would make it in a managed service provider anyways, which is why we target candidates working for managed service providers.
Yeah, I think there's exceptions. I always look at when I was in the space, it was one of those things where you look at what is their potential or willingness to be coached. Like you can just see that they have a drive. They have this innate, like, to what you described of like, I'm going to fix the go-kart, take the governor out. I'm going to go 55, not 25. But there's also that idea that, you know, if you're self-taught, you don't necessarily know that that was 2 hours too long, or, you know, you don't have the perspective. Like, I think that in what I learned from then to now on my MSP and other MSPs later is that to us in our little bubble, we were doing a great job at being an MSP, even in our peer group. Like, we saw areas for improvement, but it wasn't like I had to fix the whole company. But then I left after selling the MSP and going to two more, and I realized a lot of things that we had been doing very, very poorly. And It wasn't until I got outside of my own sort of shell that I saw that and had somebody come in and said, I want to coach you where you are as a level two engineer. I would have probably been open to it because I wouldn't have known, like, I wouldn't have had any reason not to be open to it. Like, it wasn't like they're coming in and saying, you're bad at what you do, let me coach you. It would have, because that's not what coaches do, right? So I just wonder, like, sometimes, like, do you have candidates that you might not even give a second thought because they're too much in the weeds of, like, well, I don't care how many times the timer goes off. That's just letting me reinforce that I will figure this out no matter how long it takes.
Yeah, so we don't really move forward with all candidates. And sure, there's a lot of things that can be involved in that process. Can we identify if somebody's going to be like that? I think we can figure that out with a lot of other things, like, are they going to be on time when we agreed to talk sure. with them? Are they, you know, what is, how timely are they? If you're talking about time,
sure.
are they going to be 5 minutes late every single time we want to do, like, a touch point or something like that? Because then, you know, if they're not able to track time or be on time, well, guess what? They're
yeah.
probably not going to be good with time when they're billable.
Sure. Or which I guess that gets into a whole nother, whole other, yeah. You know, showing up late once, having a really good excuse once or twice, not a big deal. But if you have a great excuse every time we're supposed to meet, then we have some serious potential. It's not going to work out.
Then it's the speech about the difference between reasons and excuses.
Sure. Yeah. And the fact that we're having to discuss the differences between the two should already be clear how this is going to go.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's like, hey, they didn't show up again. Thank you very much. I would never want to. You talked about, like, account managers and salespeople. We don't recruit salespeople. We don't recruit account managers.
Got
because,
it.
You know, I think they're all good. If they're a good salesperson, or even if they're okay, I still think they're good because I believe people are typically, you know, good people.
Sure.
So if they're telling me something, yeah, maybe I'm kind of gullible in a way when it comes down to it. But salespeople, the really good ones, they're all going to be good in my mind.
It's like giving a mechanic a Swiss Army knife to fix a car. Can he do it? Probably. Is it the right tools that he would normally or she normally use? Probably not. And I think that's one of the things you see challenging with account managers and salespeople is, are they being given a Swiss Army knife to try and pull off selling something? Or are they actually being given the appropriate tools to be successful? And if you see them be successful with the Swiss Army knife, you're like, that one, that's the one I want.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the real strategic ones who know how to answer questions really, really well.
Sure.
And they get plugged into a tactical position where they're not set up to succeed because they're strategic. So they look like they failed, but they just haven't been put in the right role at the right time in their career.
Yeah. So I want to cover a couple other categories that I think you guys focus on. I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on this one, but I wanted to bring it up anyways, the salary discussion. Obviously, this is on two sides of a coin. You've got the discussion with the MSP, you're helping to recruit, you know, what's your budget look like, setting realistic expectations. What does that look like when you start going after, does that make it harder? Like, so if I'm the MSP and I'm like, hey, our budget is, you know, we're looking for a level two, our budget's no higher than 85K, you're immediately like, we can work with that. But if they're like, our budget is 55K and we want a level two, level three, does that create pause for you with the MSP? Or is it like, you're looking at, like, what's the demographic area that we're looking for candidates for this job that we know probably are going to get plugged in remotely anyways?
Yeah, cost of living is definitely taken under consideration in that case. But you kind of have to take what the MSP says at face value. They also, the partners that we work with tend to want to know what my take is on that. And we have all the data in the world
sure.
to kind of support, you know, the salaries that have been accepted at different levels, at various positions all over the country and different.
Level set my expectations of not understanding because I don't do this every day.
True, true. And the ones who come in a little bit lower are used to hiring, hiring applicants who might not be from the industry. So, yeah, they are going to be a little bit lower. But guess what? an extra $5,000 on the salary to get somebody who doesn't require as much handholding, who gets up to speed quicker, who you know is going to be able to handle the volume of the tickets and the customers and all that. There's absolute value in there. And I have plenty of testimonials of customers even this year saying, Ted, we hired this guy. It's a night and day difference. The next time we need to hire, come back to you. He's already paid his fee and it's like 6 weeks later.
So now you're interviewing. We've got the candidate.
Yeah.
What does that look like? What's that?
Salary. We're stuck on salary. Yeah.
Right. So let's say we figured out, we've got salary figured out. Now it's like determining, okay, I've got this candidate or these three candidates. They want one. What is your average interview process look like? Are you trying to like, hey, maybe fingers crossed, the first candidate I give them, they're like, yep, we want this one. Or do you generally try to get two or three in front of them? So it's not like a, you know, did I get the right candidate? And if so, then obviously that's why I hired you, right? You found the right candidate for me. If it's a match, we're done. Because who wants to keep interviewing?
In a highly populated area, like let's say Chicago or New York City, it might take a little bit higher number of candidates than an area that's not as populated, like you know, the College Station, Texas, or so, where there's absolutely no MSPs, or Eureka, California, where there's two MSPs, right? So in those cases, it might take only one. I'm a kind of a statistical recruiting nerd, so on the average, one in every five candidates that we send to a client gets an offer and gets hired. So I know that somewhere statistically, that's all going to have to balance out at some point. There's going to be some customers who hire you know, who have a larger number, or some that have a smaller number. There was one situation where we had a rec open. We submitted a candidate who we already had in our pipeline. The candidate was scheduled to interview. They finished their entire interview process that afternoon. We got the request to do an offer. We made the offer, closed the offer in one day.
But that's not what you lead with on your website, because that would be like, sorry, we failed you. This is the exception to the rule.
You don't want to
underpromise, overdeliver.
It's a 2 to 4 week thing. But the salary thing, just to drive that home, is that if a candidate, it's another data point from a candidate to know that they're good, if they're reasonable on their salary expectations.
Sure.
If they're not reasonable on their salary expectations, if they're totally out of line, we you know, tend to nicely decline them, because are they going to be a headache? Are they not going to be a fit for this reason? Are they always going to ask for a raise every 3 to 6 months or so? Is that what drives them, or is what drives them the ability to solve problems and be around people that are cool, that like to do these things? Great. So on the first phone call, we talk about salary. We get an expectation. I like it when a customer says we could pay up to 85, and we find a candidate that says I would accept an offer at 70, and we ultimately end up getting that candidate an offer of 75,000, because it's more than what they expected, because they were so reasonable, and maybe just not, they don't know the market, but they're still
getting underpaid. You killed the negotiation, really, right? Like, because if I need more money than what you've offered me, that's always tough on a candidate. So that kind of goes in the full circle. But I think if we could wrap this up or tie it all together, one of the things we talked briefly about is the whole why behind this. Like, why would an MSP, and going back in time, I think I know a little bit of the answer, like the amount of effort an MSP is going to put into finding the right candidate. So talk to me a little bit about that, the things that you're solving for. That I get what you're solving for in the doing it part, but what are you offsetting that we didn't talk about at all in the last 30 minutes?
So typically when I have my new business development calls with new managed service providers, I ask them what they're currently doing. I ask a lot of questions on their current process, and it tends that it falls on the owner of the company who actually administratively posts the jobs. They're the ones that want to look at the applicants and look at the resumes, review them, and even talk to the first round of candidates, which in most cases is the magical 50 number. I don't know why, but you know, somebody, I have a customer out in California who said, all right, I need to hire somebody, went on to one of the well-known websites, posted a job, and was like, oh, I hope I get some applicants. Well, 30 minutes later, he had 700 applicants, and he said, yes, I've done it. And you know, then he had to pause the ad and he's like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so easy. I heard it was so hard. He looked at the first applicant and they were in the restaurant industry. He looked at the next applicant and they were a mechanic. And you know, and then so forth and so on. But somebody who doesn't have an eye for reading resumes, that takes sometimes 5 to 10 minutes per resume. So
Open
what?
for work, right?
Open. So I'm a stickler when it comes to efficiency. It's one of my core values. And I wasn't always in corporate like the most popular for taking, you know, being a new recruiter in a company and taking all 20 interviews that they're having per week and then saying, no, we're not interviewing that person, not that person, not that person. Hey, Ted, where are all the interviews? Well, you guys are going to start interviewing 1 to 2 people. And they did. And they would ultimately make hires for the majority of the people that they interviewed. So the value is giving time back to the owner. In
Love it.
my calculation, the owner is spending 10% of their salary per week doing the recruiting themselves. If they could have that time back and that money back to put in and invest in better things while we're being efficient with our process and scouting for their company. We're scouting constantly. I have all the data. I share the data with anybody who wants to know. I have them even look at my applicant tracking system and say, these are the candidates. We're following up and calling and texting, emailing, sending notes in LinkedIn with this amount of candidates for you in your area. And they're all qualified. They've all been with their managed service provider for at least 3 years, and they have X number of total years of experience. Sooner or later, one pops up. Two pop up, three pop up in some cases. If we can have three interviews go on, great. What ends up hiring is what ends up happening is perhaps there's another reason to hire more than one person.
So last thing, I know you guys post job openings on your website for some of these positions you're trying to fill, and we've talked about it a little bit on so far on the show about, you know, whether they're level one or level three. Do you provide criteria to the candidates, or like, do you have a like clear understanding from the MSP's request of level two, level three to like when you're talking to candidates? I feel like in my experience, there's been a lot of like, oh yeah, I'm a level three. Possibly a level four if there was level four, and you're like, okay, so they're like handle project management. They don't need to be managed at all. They're probably not someone I need to put in front of a client. They're probably involved in both the project bid process and making sure we're charging the right amount of money, and they're part of the project completion process because they architected the whole thing. Versus, no, I'm more of like, I understand your principaler is not working. Hold on, let me remote it and reset your principaler.
Yeah, titles are different with a lot of the MSPs out there. So a tier three could be an engineer at another company. So what we do is by figuring that out, it's called calibration. When we talk with the new customer or the repeat customer, we'll kind of calibrate. If it's a repeat customer, we'll kind of know where they are with their titles and what they're talking about. But we can calibrate by asking them, you know, about firewalls, routers, switches,
Sure.
servers, cloud, and what level that person might need to know if they need to have some familiarity with it, or if they have actually had to do it thousands of times, then you're talking the difference
Sort of
between
a
a tech and an engineer.
skills, I don't want to say
Matrix?
certification. Have they been initiated on these types of services? That's a good starting point.
And one more point would be salary, you know. If all of a sudden they're saying that they need somebody to configure on the command line, and then they say 80,000, it's like, well, are you in Florida? You know, because that might make sense. But you know, somebody who's on the command line, you know, configuring firewalls, routers, switches, servers, and all up the line, that's going to be a lot more. So then we have a different conversation about what's in our data.
Yeah, is this a Cisco type, you know, CCNA, or is this a no, I just know how to use command line to get into my, you know, Sonic wall.
Oh no, I've done that a billion times. Oh, you did? Well, actually, I was on a team that did it. Actually, the engineer in the team did. Oh, I thought you were the engineer. Well, that's what they called me.
Well, I'm still here. I've been here 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that was great. I think that pretty much sums it up. Is there any last sort of pieces of advice? I know we didn't really dive into like cybersecurity, but the reality is cybersecurity is either a job role or part of a job role. It's probably not when I'm hiring an engineer, I'm like, Are they cybersecurity certified? That's probably not the approach I take. So if they have understanding of the importance of cybersecurity and some of those other things, awesome. So I guess my question is, where can people find you? And, if there's anything that we missed, to go ahead and please share that with the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's start with that. And as far as the cybersecurity piece, the managed service providers who I talk to, I usually ask about their marketing strategies. And, if they have a strong marketing strategy, then they're going to have a strong need to hire. If they're getting referrals, typically they're not going to need to hire all the time if they don't, if they're not out there doing marketing. If they don't have cybersecurity services to offer, I usually, end up talking to the managed service providers who grow the most that offer cybersecurity services right now. It's hot. It's hot as can be. If you're an MSP out there and you're looking for a gateway to more customers, offer cybersecurity services for sure right now. It is the key, in my opinion. Your listeners can find me on LinkedIn. That's my as my one of my friends called me. I'm never on Facebook or any of the other things typically. My kingdom is LinkedIn. I've got like 12, 13,000 followers or something like that. My website is verticaltalentsolutions.com. And LinkedIn though is where if I get a message from somebody who has a question, I typically respond pretty quickly unless I'm asleep.
And just so everybody knows, I found Ted on the first try on LinkedIn.
Whoa, how about that?
I spelled
Nice.
wait and Ted correctly, I think was the kicker.
Nice.
So
That's good to know that there's only one Ted White out there.
I didn't say that. It was the first one that popped up. I didn't actually read to see if there were more. I just saw that it matched the job function was consistent with the person I'm talking to, so I thought that would work. I appreciate your time. For those of you listening, this has been an episode of 1337. Thanks and have a great week.
Thank you.